Welcome to another installment of Voices of the Middle East. This is Gudarz Ekhtedari, your host. The program today is a pre-recorded lecture of a panel discussion at Portland State University with regards to the events of North Africa and Middle East. The first speaker is Professor Lindsay Benstead, who is Assistant Professor of Political Science at Portland State, where she teaches courses on North African politics, Middle East politics, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, authoritarianism and democratization, and research methods. She has held graduate and postdoctoral fellowships at the Council on Middle East Studies at Yale University and the Department of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University. Dr. Benstead received her PhD in public policy and political science from University of Michigan Ann Arbor. Her dissertation investigated the relationships between parliamentary institutions, the constituency activities of members, and the political attitude of constituents in Morocco and Algeria. During 18 months of field research in Morocco and Algeria, Professor Benstead conducted a survey of a couple hundred members of parliament and 1,600 constituents in 20 electoral districts. Professor Benstead is currently writing a book on political clientelism in Morocco and Algeria.
Right. Well, thank you very much for that introduction. I'm really delighted to be talking about North Africa specifically. It's really interesting. This sub-region of the Middle East, the broader Middle East, is relatively marginalized in academia. Since this is the place, Tunisia is the place where the Arab Spring, or actually, as I'll say in my talk, the second Arab Spring began. It's really interesting and important, I think, to have a chance to talk about the classical Maghreb specifically. In order to address the question of why revolution has occurred in Tunisia, why it's begun in Libya, not in Morocco and Algeria, and how we should understand those events, how they're likely to unfold, I'd like to start with just a little bit of an overview of the history of the four political regimes. Raise your hand if you feel like you have a pretty good sense of what the form of government is in the four countries in the classical Maghreb: Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, and Libya. Probably quite a few of you. I see a number of students or former students and others who are from the region. Okay, so I'll just say a few things just really generally about this. Morocco, so these are all post-colonial states. They have certain commonalities politically and certain differences. Morocco became independent from France in 1956. Since its independence, has had three kings. The current king of Morocco is King Mohammed VI, who came to power in 1999 when his father passed away. I also should mention that all four of these states have authoritarian regimes, although they differ in terms of the extent to which they've undergone political liberalization. So since the mid-1980s, Morocco has undergone probably the most significant political liberalization in the region. Algeria became independent from France in 1962, it has had a presidential republic, basically a dominant party system that is effectively run by the military behind the scenes. It's had about a dozen presidents. The current president is Abdelaziz Bouteflika. And most significantly, many of you will know that during the liberalization experience at the end of the 1980s, when the country held its first free and fair elections, the first time that multiple parties were allowed in elections, the Islamic Salvation Front, a political Islamist party, won the elections, and then there was a coup when the military canceled the elections. So that's a little bit about Algeria. Tunisia, also a former French protectorate, independent in 1956. Two presidents until 2011, effectively. Habib Bourguiba, president until 1987, when he was deposed through a coup by now former president Ben Ali. Tunisia had liberalized quite significantly, then reversed back to a pretty closed form of authoritarianism. And as we know, the Jasmine Revolution ended the the regime headed by President Ben Ali in January. Finally, Libya is the one country, other than Tunisia, Libya is really the one country where there has been a revolution since it became independent from Italy, in this case, in 1951, so after the Second World War. There was a king, Idris I, the Senussi Order dynasty, until 1969, when Muammar Gaddafi came to power in a coup. Libya has a very unique political system. It's completely closed. It's a completely closed authoritarian regime. It's formally a state of the masses. It's a form of direct democracy, but has not undergone any political liberalization since the 80s. There have been some economic reforms, however. Colonel Gaddafi is the longest-serving political leader in the Arab world, or head of state. All right. So first of all, why has unrest occurred in North Africa? Well, there are a number of different reasons, some of them at least relate to the crisis of legitimacy of these leaders, effectively. There are a few different ways that authoritarian regimes can build legitimacy, and a few of those are regimes can have sort of historical or nationalist legitimacy. So presidents like Muammar Gaddafi, for example, the presidents of Algeria, can come up with unified nationalist ideology to build legitimacy. Monarchs like King Mohammed VI can use historical, religious, or hereditary legitimacy. But over time, some of these sources of legitimacy break down, and they're no longer compelling to the population. So this is one form of legitimacy. The second is economic legitimacy. So maintaining a favorable standard of living and a favorable, essentially, economic bargain with your population. And the third is democratic legitimacy. So what we saw, for example, in Algeria in the 1980s, as economic legitimacy deteriorated, and as the standard of living decreased, as it did also in Egypt in the last few years, the regime then has to rely on other sources of legitimacy. And in the case of Algeria, the regime was 50 years on from independence, and so could no longer rely on this source of revolutionary legitimacy, this idea that we've helped the country become independent from the French. And so it relied on democratic legitimacy and tried to, in the 1980s, make political reforms and to call them democratization as a way of building a new source of legitimacy. So why do I mention this? Well, first of all, I notice Wikipedia is calling this the Arab Spring, this current sort of round of protest that's spreading and revolution that's spreading through the region. But actually, there was another Arab Spring that took place in the 1980s, and there were also major protests in a lot of places. It wasn't as widespread as it is today. But this happened in the 1980s, and in a way, I would argue that what's happening now is not a second Arab Spring, but it's really the continuation of demands that people in the Arab world started to make decades ago. And initially, they were unsuccessful in achieving democracy in the 1980s. Hopefully, we all hope that they will be successful in the next few years in that goal. But then in the 1980s, as now, this unrest was sparked by a decline in economic legitimacy. So a decline in economic conditions such that people in this region were no longer happy with what their regimes were providing for them in terms of jobs, standard of living, and so on. And related to that, of course, is corruption and nepotism. So not only is my standard of living going down, not only am I unemployed, but those that I see in power are doing just fine. They have apartment buildings in Paris. They're benefiting from the oil and so on. So in the 80s, as now, there really was a decline in economic legitimacy. And in the 1980s, governments tried to build democratic legitimacy through this process of democratization or liberalization that, as I said, failed. So how is this wave different from the 1980s in ways that might come to bear on the likelihood that it may be more successful in terms of bringing democratization? Well, first of all, regimes can no longer rely on this claim that they're building democratic legitimacy, because that's a hollow claim, given that many regimes said that they were reforming in the 1980s, and that didn't happen. And in my view, that's one reason why protests in Tunisia and Egypt and so on, Syria, Yemen, that's one reason why people are calling for the removal of leaders, because that sort of source or potential source of legitimacy is hollow, if you will. The second difference is, quite remarkably, we've seen a change in what you might call external legitimacy. So in the 1980s, many Western countries still thought that the autocrat was sort of the lesser of the two evils. Compared to having an Islamic takeover, Islamic government, actually the autocrat would be slightly better than that. And certainly more in line with what we think our interests are. And yet we've started to see, for example, President Obama make statements that are supporting the people, and even to say that Muammar Gaddafi is not the legitimate leader of the Libyan people, if you will. So there's really, if you compare what's happening now to what happened in the 1980s, you see different external conditions. And of course, the third difference is the factor of the internet. The internet has provided new spaces for organizing, and it's altered the relative power between the opposition and the regime by creating these new spaces. And also, it's affecting this external legitimacy, because it's allowing the world to see what's going on inside of the countries. And second, the technology is altering the relative power or the distribution of power across the different types of opposition, secular and Islamist, because it's sort of open to all. In the 1980s, the only place you could associate freely was the mosque. So governments cracked down on that. But this new space, arguably, is something that's open to different kinds of opposition, and probably ultimately that's good for the prospects of democratization, because there's more competition there. Okay, so in conclusion, my own view is that regime change in one form or another is inevitable, basically every place in this region. And it's likely to unfold very differently in different places. I think whether we will see the removal of a government and the emergence of a new type of regime, or whether we'll see some kind of reform and democratization of regimes that stay in place, it might depend on the regime type, in the sense that you'll notice that those regimes that have crumbled all have something in common. Tunisia, Egypt, Libya threatened, Syria and Yemen very threatened. These are all dominant party regimes. These aren't monarchies. These are dominant party regimes. And those are the sorts of regimes that are struggling most to build legitimacy based on nationalist ideologies like the Third Universal Way and so on that are no longer compelling. Okay. These differences in regime type might help us understand why revolts have turned to revolution in some countries and not others, but I think we're really at the beginning of changes that will be relatively dramatic, will take a number of years to unfold, and will probably leave the region very different from what it is today. We certainly hope that one or more democracies will emerge, and that institutions will be built that protect human rights and provide for rule of law and so on. But at this moment, we're just sort of waiting to see how the transitions that are ongoing now will turn out. So thank you for your attention. I'm certainly happy to address your questions about what I've said or related issues.
Well, thank you very much. Now we go to the far end of the panel, and Professor Nabil Boudra is a associate professor of French and Francophone literature at Oregon State University. He's a graduate of Louisiana State University. He got his PhD in French and Francophone studies, specializing in North Africa, Sub-Saharan and Caribbean literature and culture. He has also served as visiting professor at Purdue, the same field of study. He is going to talk more in detail in Algeria and the Morocco.
Thank you. I think I'll be brief because I don't want to repeat the same points made by my colleague Lindsay. And unlike Lindsay and my colleague Keith, I'm not in political science or linguistics, I'm in literature, but I assure you my talk has nothing to do with fiction. It's not based on fiction. In fact, I will just draw from my own personal experience as an Algerian who grew up in Kabylie, in Kabylia, so it's a Berber speaking region. So actually, I would be coming from this minority perspective. When I reflect about what is going on here in North Africa, I try to answer this question, why these events went eastward instead of westward, why this didn't happen really in Algeria or Morocco. But so I'll focus on Algeria mostly. And I would give you the context with some differences between, of course, this group of countries, Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, and Algeria with Morocco on the other side. Of course, we have to mention similarities. Lindsay said a lot of things about what makes these countries alike. I mean, the common things, and you all know them, all Islamic countries. Poverty, face current problems of poverty, unemployment, of course, dictatorship, corruption, nepotism, and other social problems. But here's how Algeria, in my opinion, is different. In Algeria, the army is the problem. Unlike Tunisia, for example, or Egypt, in Tunisia, as you know, the army was protecting the people, actually, from the brutality of the police. In Algeria, the problem since 1962 is the army. And they are the ones who hold the power, and we can just say it's held by a group of, a small group of generals. So they are the ones making everything happen. They are the ones holding the power. And the presidents we see, maybe less with Bouteflika because he knows the system and he is trying to show he's in control, but most of them since 1962 are just puppets, really, for the show. The second difference is Algeria, unlike most of these countries, has the misfortune of oil. I said misfortune because if this happened in another country, I would say, or another period of time, I would have said fortune of oil, but it's actually a bad thing for Algerians. One of the top producers and reserves of oil and gas in the world is Algeria. For example, this year they are expecting $57 billion from oil. Just to give you an idea, I think only less than 1% of this income goes for the people. So you can say 57 million is spent for the people, and 57, so the rest, 57 billion, goes into the pockets of these generals or of the government officials. So corruption is a big issue in Algeria. For example, last year I was in Algeria, and in the news there was this minister who stole about $3 billion, and nothing happened. I mean, just they gave him some hard time, but then, of course, they dropped the charges and everything else. So that's a common thing in Algeria. And of course, this oil issue led to consequences like resentment. So people today, one of the things that concerns them most is why am I in this difficult situation, no jobs, no high rise of prices, and these top officials are stealing millions, if not billions of dollars. So it created this resentment which which increased from the 70s and 80s, because that's when this corruption started. With Boumediene in the 70s, it was less. And also the second problem with oil, and that's why I said misfortune, because it gave Algeria a kind of socialism. That's the model they followed since 1962. And so everything relied on oil revenues, unlike Tunisians, for example, or Moroccans, where they developed tourism, agriculture, and everything else. Algeria relied entirely on oil, and that became kind of fatal to development. So my conclusion for this point is the government is very rich, actually very rich. They use that money to buy peace. For example, a few months ago there was this riot by pharmacists or doctors, I don't remember. And the government, what they do is they just take some of that money and they buy peace, you see. So they know how to control these revolts. And I said rich because France did something very, let's say, ridiculous a few months ago when the riot started in Tunisia. They gave 350,000 euros. They said, hey, we'll help you with that. I mean, that's ridiculous. 350,000 euros in Algeria wouldn't have happened because it's like a slap in the face, really. The other difference is the minority issue. I think so far, for example, when you think of Egypt and Tunisia, for example, I think these revolutions have been, I wouldn't use the word homogeneous, but there is kind of national unity, national agreement on these things, but that can't happen in Algeria, because you have the minority issue, which kind of divides the people into different groups, and national cohesion didn't, unfortunately, happen. For example, the Berbers have suffered since 1962 from exclusion, and they have staged several revolts in the past. For example, you mentioned the Berber of Arab Spring, so we have the Berber Spring of April 1980, where when the Berbers tried to not only claim equality in terms of identity, language, recognition, and so forth, but also for social and political issues. Of course, the media at that time were just saying that the Berbers are separatists. They just want a country by themselves, but it wasn't true. They were social for social issues concerning everybody in the country. So I think of it as there is no solidarity between these groups, which makes it harder for the Algerians to carry on a revolution like the Jasmine Revolution. And the proof is that in Kabylia now, they say, well, okay, true, we did these revolts several times and we were by ourselves, and now we're just gonna, you know, not be silent, but do it in another way, in a different way. Fear, another difference is fear. I think Algerians are still haunted by the what they call décennie noire, the black decade. I mean, it's the civil war of the 1990s, during which more than 200,000 people died within a few years, which basically started in 1992 and ended just before Bouteflika came to power in 1999. So they are still afraid of this movement of Islamists / terrorists, and I think the Tunisians were smart because they learned from that lesson. And you can see how they didn't allow the Islamists to hijack the revolution. When you think of the riots a few weeks ago or a couple of months ago, you see how they excluded the Islamists from the riots. They didn't want them to be part of it. This is a clean revolution that belongs to the people. See? So that's something that unfortunately didn't happen in Algeria, mostly in the 1990s. So the other thing is they are fed up. Algerians, I think, are kind of tired of of revolutions. The one I mentioned in 1980, and then there was one in 1963, also in Kabylia against Ben Bella, the president at that time. And then there was the famous October 88, when more than 500 people died in Algiers. Exactly the same reasons, same riots, same context. And of course, I mentioned the civil war of the 1990s. And in 2001 and 2003, again in Kabylia, you have you have social protests against the government, demanding more equal rights, more equality, and so forth. So, to me, it's like they don't believe in hope anymore. They have been doing this for a long time. Every decade there is a big revolution, but nothing happens because they change presidents, but it's always the same scenario, and most of the time it's even worse. The other reason is most of the intellectuals fled the country. They, from the 1990s, they were targeted. A lot of them, a lot of intellectuals, writers, journalists, were killed. So most of them had to go, mostly to France and even to the United States. So there is this gap, and there is this void here in organizing the revolt. And that's something that's unfortunate. The youngsters now in Algeria, I mean, they carry on revolts and riots, but they are less organized. And finally, just a couple of points as concluding remarks. Like I said, so far most of these revolutions have been clean, just no negative references to the U.S., for example. They don't mention Islam has nothing to do with religion. And so far, I noticed there's no references to Israel, for example. And so it's just a people's movement. And I think that's exactly what this is about. And I think we have enough reasons, really, to take out all these leaders for the same points I mentioned above. I mean, just based on the human rights. They did this with Saddam 20 years ago, I mean, a few years ago. And I think just based on human rights, it was enough to say enough. I mean, just leave. The scorn, especially the scorn, these leaders, that's something in common that they have towards their people. They have so much hatred. I mean, they spoil their riches and everything, but they are very scornful. And the Algerian government, for example, has been reacting with silence. A lot of people have been demanding equal rights and everything, but so silence has been the motto of the Algerian government. And a lot of people say, why this isn't happening in Algeria? I think it's not true, because there have been revolts in Algeria almost every day. In fact, more than 20 people burned themselves in the past few months, but it's just that there is less coverage, and like they say back home, Algeria is just like a bomb that's waiting to explode, and we're still wondering what's going to happen next. Thank you,
Professor Walter is a linguist. A professor of linguistic at Portland State University. He's a graduate of UT Austin and had taught prior to coming to Portland State at UT Austin, as well as the English department at Ohio State University. One of the interesting comments that Dr. Walters wrote in his introduction to me is that he considers himself especially lucky to have worked with graduate students from Morocco, Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Lebanon, and the occupied territories. He's currently teaching a course on language and nationalism in the Middle East. And with that, I welcome Professor Walters.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming tonight. I've been to Sidi Bouzid, a small town in central Tunisia, World War II buffs know that a battle took place there between the Germans and the Americans in February of 1943. It was the prelude to what became known as the Battle of Kasserine Pass. The Americans didn't fare too well there, leading the Germans to underestimate the ability of the Americans and the American forces to rethink their strategies. Like so many Tunisian towns that aren't on the coast, where the tourist, much of the industry, and the job opportunities that both bring are, and where the country's political and social elite have hailed from, Sidi Bouzid isn't especially memorable to outsiders. If you visit there, or lots of towns and cities across the region, you'll see hosts of young, unemployed men on the street, sometimes sitting in cafes, sometimes just standing around. In fact, Tunisians have traditionally referred to these young men as hitist, a word that is part Arabic and part French, evidence of widespread bilingualism and language play in the region. The suffix East is, of course, the suffix of Marxist, communist, Zionist, realist, or biologist, and means someone who knows about a particular field or is committed to a specific body of ideas. The first part of the word hit is the Arabic word for wall. In other words, these young men's job is holding up the walls, no other opportunities being available to them, whether because of their limited educations or because of the current job market. In Sidi Bouzid, the unemployment rate is estimated to be 30%. I'll bet it's higher for these young men. Sidi Bouzid is, of course, where what some claim may become the most significant series of political events in the last 50 years in the Arab world started. It was there last December 17th that 26-year-old Mohamed Bouazizi, a street vendor, set himself afire at about lunch one day after local officials refused to see him when he went to complain because of how he'd been treated that morning by a young female police officer. Reports tell us that Bouazizi sold produce on the street from a cart or a wheelbarrow, making about $140 a month. That's about $1,680 a year in a country where the GDP is over twice that. Like well over 95% of Tunisian children, boys and girls, he'd received some education. He attended a one-room school about 12 miles from Sidi Bouzid, but he never finished high school. One of six children, with a stepfather, his uncle, who was unable to work. Bouazizi had been working part-time since he was 10 and full-time since his late teens. In fact, his earnings supported his mother, his stepfather, and younger siblings. They were also helping pay for a younger sister to go to university. He'd managed to buy electronic scales to use in weighing the vegetables, an expensive investment in a small town in Tunisia, and he hoped one day to own a truck to use in his business. The night before he took his life, he'd bought about $200 worth of fruits and vegetables that he'd counted on selling the following day. If he was selling that amount of produce daily and clearing only $140 a month, you get some idea of how narrow his profit margin was. From this point on, the narratives about what happened are contested. One thing it's important to remember about all the Middle East is that it's a region of contested narratives, stories of reality and truth that are in some sense irreconcilable or even incommensurable. In other words, it's impossible to put the narratives together into a coherent whole. What is truth or reality for one group is misrepresentation or even lies for the other. Perhaps a measure of the health of the social order is the extent to which the narratives told by members of a society or neighboring societies can be assembled into a coherent narrative. It's not clear whether independent street vendors have to have a permit to sell their wares in Tunisia, though Bouazizi's supporters contend he'd been getting hassled mercilessly for months by the police because he didn't have one. There is agreement that being poor, he had no money to offer the police bribes. Not so long ago, Tunisia was not a country of bribes. Sure, there'd long been corruption at the highest levels. Otherwise, how could those in power have lived such opulent lives? But unlike some countries in the Arab world, getting through daily life wasn't built on a parallel economy of sorts that consisted of paying everyone off for favors or assistance. All that had come to Tunisia with the late Ben Ali years, and Tunisians pointed to the president and especially his wife's family as being the models everyone else was emulating. That is, if they dared speak at all. Increasingly, Tunisia had become a police state of sorts, Tourists who visited there generally didn't notice, but folks who spoke any Arabic sure did. You realized that everywhere you went, there were plainclothes policemen. If you were a foreigner, your friends told you not to talk about politics at all in public places, even in hushed tones. As a Persian proverb famously says, the walls have mice, and the mice have ears. Tunisian friends describe situations much like those I'd known in my adolescence in the rural South during the civil rights era and the Vietnam War. Even at home, many families simply never spoke about what was going on in society, because polarization within the family was so strong that any effort at discussion could only end up in shouting matches. In Tunisia, if the neighbors overheard you, you could be in big trouble when that happened. Better simply to remain silent. As a Tunisian friend about my age who was visiting from the States reported to me, her sister had finally pulled her aside and begged her simply to keep her mouth shut, because in such situations, talking could only lead to sorrow. During an interview with one of the international news agencies, Bouazizi's sister commented, "What kind of repression do you imagine it takes for a young man to do this? A man who has to feed his family by buying goods on credit when they fine him and take his goods? In Sidi Bouzid, those with no connections and no money for bribes are humiliated and insulted and not allowed to live." If you've read about this situation, you're aware that the humiliation and insult weren't just about poverty and extortion. Bouazizi's family claims he was publicly humiliated by the policewoman. While they claim that she slapped him, spat at him, confiscated his scales, overturned his cart, and even hurled an insult at his dead father, they also acknowledge that the fact that she was a woman made all these things even worse. It's important for you to realize that Tunisian women enjoy rights their Arab and Muslim sisters across the Arab world generally don't. Since 1957, matters of personal status, that is, laws relating to marriage and the family, have been subject to civil laws rather than religious laws. In 1957, polygamy was outlawed, women as well as men could file for divorce, and birth control and abortion were available on demand for women. While it's certainly true that tradition prevented some Tunisian women from taking advantage of these rights, it's also true that Tunisian women are aware that they have rights many other Arab or Muslim women don't, and that they're the envy of some Arab and Muslim women. A Tunisian doctoral student of mine who was in her late 40s at the time was amazed when she arrived in the United States in the early 1990s and discovered that some people, including women, opposed the idea of a woman's having access to abortion. For her, as an educated Tunisian woman, that issue had long been settled. My point isn't to argue about for or against abortion, but to note the diversity that exists across the Arab Muslim world with respect to the issue of women's rights. Let's return to Sidi Bouzid, a fairly small town, though it's the capital of the state, in what's a very conservative part of the country. Public life in Tunisia, as in most if not all the countries of the Arab Muslim world, has become increasingly conservative over the past few decades. When I first went to Tunisia in the mid-1970s, Tunisians in urban areas who weren't keeping the fast during the month of Ramadan might have a cup of coffee or pastry in public. Not in the streets. Tunisians generally don't eat on the streets the way Americans increasingly seem to. Wine was still displayed and sold in stores. By the mid-1980s, things had changed. Those who wanted a snack might go buy one in a shop, put it in their bag, return to their office, close the door, and eat it. The wine in grocery stores was covered up, and to get it, you had to go to the side entrance and buy it undercover. And basically, it was the alcoholics and the foreigners who were there buying the wine. By the late 1990s, the wine had disappeared completely during the month of Ramadan. Across these decades, a growing number of women had adopted what I'll term conservative Islamic dress. While Tunisian women had always dressed modestly and that they were covered from below their elbows to below their knees, Tunisian men were the same way, some women began wearing longer dresses or skirts, they covered themselves to the wrist, and they took up the hijab, which they would remove only in the presence of women and children or close male relatives by blood or marriage. This practice contrasted with the wearing of the safsari, which is more or less like a large sheet that a woman wrapped around her body before she left the house to go out in public. Both are about modesty, but they encode it in very, very different ways and have very different social meanings. Of course, many Tunisian women of my generation have never worn either. Like modern women across the Arab world, they have no interest in doing so, seeing the hijab and the safsari as markers of oppression, as have many Western feminists. Those among them who are devout show their devotion in other ways. Tunisia's first president, Habib Bourguiba, of whom you saw a photo, and who served from independence in 56 until he was replaced November 7, 1987, by Ben Ali in a bloodless coup, had railed against the Safsari, calling it that filthy rag. Despite his efforts, many women, especially those who were poorer or less educated, continued to wear it. In fact, when poor rural women who'd never been able to wear it in the fields, because you just can't pick vegetables and wear a safsari, migrated to the city, one of the first things they did, and still do, was begin wearing the safsari as evidence of their new urban status. The first time a Tunisian woman wore a hijab on television was during Ramadan in 1975, when Bourguiba invited Hind Shelby, the daughter of a Quranic scholar, and a Quranic scholar in her own right, to address the country on issues of women and Islam. She showed up at the TV station wearing the hijab, but the show had to go on. This was surely not what Bourguiba had intended. He, like Ben Ali and many leaders across the Arab world, sought to appropriate both Islam and women's rights and to use them as instruments for building the state as he saw fit. We shouldn't be surprised, then, that the expression of public piety has increased across the Arab world. Whatever else they may mean, such expressions have been one of the few ways that citizens have had of expressing their displeasure with their government locally or their displeasure with what some have come to term Western Islamophobia. Returning to Sidi Bouzid, I think it's certainly plausible that a young man, one of society's dispossessed, would find being stopped by a female police officer humiliating. Not only was she a woman, odds are she made a lot more money than he did. It's also important to realize that across the Arab world, a child becomes an adult in some real sense when she or he marries, and a young man can't, in most cases, marry until he can afford a place for him and his bride to live. Remember the Hittites I spoke of earlier? They're generally unemployed, and watching their lives pass by them, realizing their future possibilities are very, very slim and getting slimmer all the time. Bouazizi had at least found a way to make $140 a month. The officer's family provides a very different story about what happened. Yes, the officer confiscated his wares, but none of those other things happened. Some of what's being played out here is the local notion of honor, and honor across the Arab world is different in crucial ways from the way that Americans generally conceive of it. Please note my point. It isn't just Arabs who have a strong sense of honor, but we just conceptualize it differently, and it plays a very different role in our lives than theirs. Again, however, we find irreconcilable narratives about what happened or what it means, and gender plays a role in these narratives. While the situation of Tunisian women has progressed since 1956, not everyone sees that as an especially good thing, as the rise of the public piety movement demonstrates. We have our own version of that situation as well, where societal debates are fought out over women's bodies. Like Christianity, Islam prohibits suicide. Thus, understandably, when Muhammad Bouazizi set himself afire and later died, he became a shaheed, a martyr. The Arabic word comes from the verb meaning to see or to witness. Muhammad Bouazizi was witness to his own situation. His actions, radical in a Tunisian context, represented what many saw as an understandable response to the frustration and humiliation of his daily life. And it's this sense of frustration and humiliation that resonated with people across Tunisia and continues to resonate with others across the region. Of Bouazizi, I'll say what all Tunisians would say, Allah yarhamu, may God grant him mercy. And to those who hope for a brighter future for these countries, like Tunisians, I'll add, inshallah, that God may will it. Let me close by making three observations about what we've been talking about tonight. First, one thing I hope these events is helping Americans appreciate is the diversity of the Arab world. These countries aren't interchangeable. In some countries, the cleavages are economic and regional. In others, they're religious, or ethnic. In all cases, people are fed up with rulers who are completely out of touch with those they rule and those whose self-serving corruption can in no way be denied. And this does seem to be true everywhere, as Nabil has said. Okay. And this is especially true of the youth who fear they have no real future under the current circumstances. Tunisians are proud of and anxious about their Jasmine Revolution. They're proud of what they've achieved with very little violence or chaos, but anxious because they remember well the hopes and expectations they had when Ben Ali replaced Bourguiba in 1987. hopes and expectations that were not just dashed, but even cruelly mocked by the corruption of Ben Ali and the systems he put in place. The second topic I'll mention is the European Union. Yesterday's New York Times reminds us that 23,000 would-be immigrants have shown up in Italy since January, many from Tunisia, especially from places like Sidi Bouzid, but increasingly from Libya. In this latter case, large numbers are sub-Saharans who were working in Libya. This displacement represents a threat to the Union itself, one where relations are already seriously frayed because of the economic crisis of the past few years. For years, European countries had agreements with those who ruled North Africa that kept the North Africans home. But guess what? Those agreements no longer hold. Where will this dilemma leave Europe? Finally, an additional thing to think about as you ponder these popular movements taking place across the Arab world is what consequences they might have for Israel and the complex relationship that the United States has with Israel and its neighbors. All involved have favored stability while ignoring the aspirations of the region's population, especially the young people there. At this point, at least, it seems that whatever the proper balance between stability and populist aspirations, it's being renegotiated in this region of irreconcilable narratives. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. This was another installment of Voices of the Middle East with Gudar Zaktidari, your host. The program today was a pre-recorded panel discussion under the title of Focus on North Africa, a Second Roundtable on the Middle East, that was recorded on April 15 at Portland State University. The speakers were Professor Lindsay Benstead, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Portland State, and Professor Nabil Boudra, Associate Professor of French and Francophone Studies at Oregon State University, and Professor Keith Walters, a professor of applied linguistics at Portland State University. The moderator was Gudar Zaktidari. Thank you for listening and have a good day.